Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The 56th annual New York Film Festival is in full swing, and we're bringing you coverage of the festival through a series of conversations with actors and directors whose films are featured this year. One of those films is Private Life, directed by Tamara Jenkins. In Private Life, 41-year-old writer Rachel and her husband Richard, a 47-year-old who runs a small theater company, get caught up in the fertility industrial complex as they try to have a child and the lengths they are willing to go to do so, even if it rocks their marriage.
Are you blaming me?
No, I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying that we need to take some responsibility for the situation.
A lot of women have babies at 41. I thought I could too.
Okay. I just don't think it's Gloria Steinem's fault that we can't get pregnant.
Whose fault is it then? I guess it is mine, because I was too busy writing my stupid book.
I didn't say that.
Ugh, all the doctors ever talk about is my advanced maternal age, my old eggs. And we're in the middle of an IVF, and oh, what a surprise. Your sperm is like on a sabbatical.
Whoa. What the hell is that supposed
Nothing.
To mean?
Nothing. Just drop it.
All I'm saying is that we can't blame Dr. Dordick or Bella Abzug or anybody else for our f-up.
You mean my f-up.
My God, why do I feel like I'm in a Wendy Wasserstein play?
The voice you may recognize is Paul Giamatti playing Richard, and Catherine Hahn plays Rachel in a role that Vulture calls, quote, dazzling. How does it feel to be dazzling, Catherine? You laugh, and I'll continue. Private Life opens at the IFC Center and on Netflix this Friday. The dazzling Catherine Hahn joins us in studio. How are you?
Oh, it's so nice to be here. Hello.
That is just funny. It's sad and funny at the same time, which is sort of at the crux of this film. It is hilarious, and it is also just makes you just feel for this couple.
Oh, that is my favorite pocket. My favorite, like, my perfect pocket is like right between like the heartbreak and the funny, you know, that like catch in your throat where you're like, oh, are you going to burst into tears or burst into laughter? And I think Tamara has captured that so perfectly in this movie.
Yeah, what kind of conversations did you have about that? Because it's a serious topic for a lot of women,
yes.
A lot of couples, yet there visually and in the script, you see the absurdity of what they have to go to. When you were talking about how to get that balance, what kind of conversations did you have?
Well, I mean, we didn't really need to because she wrote such a perfect script that it was just right in front of us. So we didn't like scene to scene have to worry about that word tone because it was just in there. So, you know, just like life, it's just like a little series of heartbreaks and triumphs, like at every turn. I mean, that this kind of assisted reproduction train that they're on is just like such a metaphor for like this existential trip that we're on of life. It's just like at every turn that there's another, like, you just never know what's around the corner. Is it like this another heartbreak or another little triumph? It's just this. It's just such a trip they're on, but they happen to be on it together. Thank God.
And then sort of, as we say, together, let's say they're sitting next to each other and then they move to different cars for a while.
Yes.
Because they really, I mean, it really takes a toll on the marriage. Can you tell me a little bit, did you and Paul create a backstory for this couple? Because we don't sort of meet them in their 40s and
right.
They're kind of doing their thing.
Right. I mean, Tamara had always talked about, like she had just mentioned while we were doing press for this, that it kind of does feel like a little like Dog Day Afternoon when you meet this couple, that you kind of are like, bam, right in the middle of this fertility struggle that they're on together. But, you know, we didn't have to build again, it's all in that amazing script that she wrote. But yeah, they'd been together for a while. You know, you kind of meet them in this kind of delayed adulthood that they're in. You know, they'd been, you know, East Villagers their whole life, whole adult life. Since like, you know, their 20s, they're artists. She's like a playwright and a writer, novelist, and he's a director. And, you know, they ran a small theater company that's no longer. And, you know, it's a kind of that feeling of like your 20s and 30s, kind of like, and all those dreams that you had that are, you still have, but they're kind of like rushed by. And all of a sudden you wake up and you're in your 40s and you're like, what? And you, they're kind of, you still have them, but you're now older and you are still in a rent stabilized apartment and you don't really have insurance, and then you're betrayed by your body and you want to have kids and it's not happening as easily. And so that's like where we meet them.
So I'm curious, do you find Rachel's character, is she angry or is she frustrated?
I think it's all of it. I think all of that. She's pissed that her body is, that she feels betrayed by her biology, for sure. Like, you know, I think that she feels like she was sold a bill of goods, that she thought that she had all this time that she was able to like devote to her writing and her life, and all of a sudden she was like, oh, it's not going to be as easy as they told me. Mm-hmm. To have a kid when I wanted to. I think she feels betrayed by that. All the things she was told that she was in control of when she was in her 20s and her feminist writing classes. And I think she's heartbroken that it's not as easy. I think she's also just really frustrated. And yeah, it's heartbreaking. And it's a very expensive. And there's also no end in sight. There's no one there to tell you to stop. Like, there's always that baby carrot now. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just try this, and they keep drawing these invisible lines in the sand of like, oh, well, I'll do this, but I'll never do that. I'll do this, but I'll never do that. And they keep getting to those lines. And then there's that possibility of a baby on the other side. And so they keep crossing those, they keep going to those other, you know, how can you say no to that? You know,
it was interesting as watching it, and I've had friends who went through IVF, yeah. And I had my son late in life, so I got the advanced maternal age
totally
lecture, right?
Me too.
When you heard AMA, you're like, what? How much research did you do?
Well, like Richard and Rachel, like, you know, it was, I think, you know, at the beginning of the movie, you see them kind of like thrown into it, and you know, they're just, you know, I think when you go through it at first, you don't, like, all those terms are coming at you, just kind of writing checks that you don't even know what you're writing checks for. You're just throwing money at it. You're just trying to play catch up. So I didn't need to do like a ton of like that kind of, I knew enough to know how out of control I would need to feel. The research I needed to do would just to feel that betrayed by my body, I think. So I watched a lot of YouTube videos of those of a lot of testimonials from couples going through it, and there's so many online, and they're heartbreaking. And so and I read a book called Avalanche, A Love Story, which was pretty incredible. And then another book called The Art of Waiting by, I think, Bell Boggs. And that was also pretty amazing. But, you know, anything that kind of would, like, as an actor, sometimes the science doesn't penetrate. You just want something that will, like, sink.
I was reading up, I read one review from sort of an indie website, and they described the film as a, quote, bona fide indie. So what does that mean to you? You've done big budget films,
right?
You know, big splashy commercial films. What does a bona fide indie mean?
Like, you all share a toilet, I guess. You all share the same toilet, I think, would be a bona fide indie. Yeah, good faith indie.
What was the shoot schedule? Was it?
It was 30 days, which was not as indie as I've done. Mm-hmm. It actually felt a little bit of breathing room, although Tamara would probably say the opposite. I think she would have loved to have kept shooting. It definitely, we shot, you know, this between January and March in New York City, and I feel like we experienced all four seasons, but never on the days that wouldn't match up with what
they were supposed to in the script.
Never. So in a very kind of Greek way, like, it felt very Greek, like we were fighting the weather in a very profound way. There was something that felt very profound about how much we were fighting the weather while
that
we were making
editor.
This movie.
That poor editor trying to match shots. Oh my gosh.
They did an amazing job. But it actually worked for the film. Like, it just felt, there was something very kind of profound about it, I thought.
We're speaking with Catherine Hahn. She's starring in a new movie called Private Life. And this movie does not happen without you. You are front and center. You are the star of this film.
Gosh, woman. It was a beautiful triangle, I think, this movie, and that beautiful head of Tamara Jenkins, for sure.
But I'm curious, what is it like to just have to, you may have to carry the movie in many ways. I know, Paul, you're great, but the movie is about this, really about this woman and her body, as you said, and you've played supporting roles in the past, but you're right in the middle of this. Tell me about the challenge of that.
Well, again, like I really didn't, it's interesting you say that because I really did go into this thinking of it as a marriage. And I did think of it, even though I knew, of course, that it was her, of course, thinking of her and Rachel's journey and that haunting and that like feeling and not being able to imagine like that kind of ache. But I also, the most, and I don't want to like do any spoilers, of course, but that they, knowing almost that it wasn't even almost about the baby. Like Paul at some point said during the movie, this isn't about the baby. This is waiting for Godot. You know what I mean? Like that there is that it was about the two of them. And they're waiting together. So much of my work in this movie is tied to him. So that, helped.
It's a partnership.
So much.
Sounds
yeah.
like it's a partnership.
For sure.
So indie films, and you've worked in the big budget films. What do you like about each?
I mean, besides the toilet situation.
And the craft services.
And the craft service. No. I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, as an actor, you have to go into both. It's the same amount of work. You know what I mean? You can't change the way you enter either of them in any way or else you can't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it funnily, like, for an actor like me, the juicier parts are always going to be the ones that are in the independent films. Like, they are always going to give me, like, the bigger parts in the. So I always feel like I'm doing the. I get the most days on those jobs. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I always feel like I'm like, feel the most like, just, it always feels like I'm in deeper in those, but just because I'm working more hours, just because it's like a bigger, mm-hmm. but you approach the work the same. You have to do the same amount of work on both, you know. I'm an actor on both, and I have to do my job on both, and I want to be there on both as badly because I love my job so much.
You said an actor like you, and I think you're referring to is I read an interesting quote where you said, I fly under the radar and it's just fab. Like you're like Donald Logue the actor. Like you guys just work and work and work.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
What does that afford you, do you think, in terms of your choices?
Well, it affords me a bunch of stuff. It affords me like a life in which I can just like, you know, do road trips with my beautiful family to like awesome Airbnbs and stop at like ye old spaghetti factories anywhere and just have the bet, you know, take my rescue dogs anywhere. And then it also affords me being not typecast and still feel like there is an element of discovery sometimes and not feel like people are like, oh, we know what she can do. So I still feel like that there's still a little bit of an element of that still.
Yeah.
Even I still feel like I'm kind of like weirdly brand new in a weird way.
That's great.
For an old horse. I still feel like I am.
I want to ask, you know, you've worked with some directors again, Jill Soloway and Tamara we've talked about. Mm-hmm. What is it that you like working with the same people? You just talked about everything being brand new,
yeah.
Yet you're working with people that you're very familiar with.
Yeah, it always feels brand new, though, for me. Like, I feel like Jill and I have been able to, like, I mean, we still find each other, like, incredibly interesting creatively and are still able to, like, there's still so much stuff left to mine there, I think. For sure. Like, we just love digging together. And Yeah, I mean, same with Tamara. Like, that was a really we just felt an instant kinship as well. Yeah, there's so many humans I want to work with again, and so many humans I can't wait to work with for the first time. Yeah.
Who would you love to work with?
Oh my gosh, there's so many people. I mean, like, I mean, there's so many. I mean, there's so many people whose visions, like, I'm like, oh God, there's so many. So many.
It's funny, if people could see you, it's like you have a Rolodex going.
Oh yeah, I literally.
Like a ticker across.
I mean, I can't even say, there's so many humans. Like, I'm just thinking of, like, I just saw Royal Tenenbaums on the plane recently, and I was like, oh. I mean, like, that kind of, like, visual world. I've never done anything that's like that stylized, and that looks like it would be really fun. Something like that.
For all your sort of deep and effect and really work that affects people, I have to say, Bad Moms.
Mama, I like that part too.
That part is great. Can you please explain to people that part and I think why it really stands out? It reminds me in the way that Melissa McCarthy stood out in Bridesmaids.
Oh, goodness gracious.
No, because it's also about class and there's like a deeper story. Can you describe the character for
folks? Loved Carla. I hear you. I love Carla. I think there's, like, I loved her because we always talked about her as, like, the Gandalf of those moms.
So the theory of the movie is that these moms just get sick of being good moms. Yeah. So they're going to go out and just rage.
Yeah. And then, Carla's kind of like the mom who just doesn't, like, she just has no filter. She really doesn't. It's not that she's, like, just Randy. It's that she really just is a loyal. She just has no filter. She has no apology. She's, like, completely authentic to who she is. She just kind of is exactly who she is. And that's what I love about her, is that she's, like, so authentically her. And that's what I love. And that's why I think she's, like, I think that there's so, I have a little Carla deep inside, but I always but I mean, she's not definitely she's aspirational for sure.
I want to talk about your writing a little bit. Two pieces of writing. The first is you wrote an essay in Glamour to yourself.
Oh, I did.
Yeah, yourself as a younger woman.
Yes.
And one of the things she wrote about is that you will grow to be so grateful for and so in love with your body. Hmm. Having children will help with that because it'll show you what you're capable of. You will look back and be so mad that you said yes to the bleach job for that gig, so glad you never got the nose job.
Yes.
Which made me think about, the reason I picked that out is because of the movie about control of your body.
Yeah.
What made you write that? Were you that person who was thinking about getting the nose job and dyeing your hair?
I hated my nose in high school so much. I hated it so much. Like, I focused on it all the time. And I'm so glad that I didn't. I really am.
Why?
Because it's who I am. And it's like, I would be so mad. I don't know if I'd be mad at myself now, but I'm really glad I didn't. That's something I could, like, pat my younger self on the back and be like, oh, honey, I'm so glad that you were gentle on yourself and you just didn't do that. I don't think my mom would have let me either, because it cost too much money.
Well, all the aspiring actresses out there who are thinking about changing their face.
Don't do it. Just be gentle on yourselves. That's all I'm saying.
And the second piece of writing is you've written a children's book, which just came out.
Yes.
What's it about?
I know. It's so crazy. I did this letter for the Lenny Letter, their first year, that was not for children, but it was called How I Learned to Be a Woman for My 6-Year-Old Daughter. And Scholastic approached me and asked if I would ever consider turning into a children's book. And I hadn't, but I was like, let's do it. It sounds so fun. And so it's called My Wish for You. And I'm really proud of it. It's really sweet and tender. And it's I kind of, like, inspired by my 6-year-old daughter and conversations I had with her, like lying in bed while she's kind of, like, monologuing to me. And it's really sweet.
That's a time when it all comes out.
It
at
does.
Bedtime.
It does. Just hearing her monologue while I'm tickling her arm. And it's like, if I could just, like, freeze that feeling and I just, things that I wish that she could just hold on to as a woman and as a human, sense of herself and sense of her authenticity. And that's kind of what we wanted to put in this little children's book. So it's called My Wish for You. Couldn't be more proud.
That's excellent. And finally, you're going to do a project for HBO, possibly? Yes, maybe?
Yes, it's called Mrs. Fletcher, based on the book by Tom Perrotta.
All right. Yeah. Excellent. Catherine Hahn, I hope you come visit us again.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much.
Catherine Hahn's new film is Private Life. It'll play at IFC Center and on Netflix October 5th. Next, we're talking about Joan of Arc's mom. And later in the show, the host of WNYC's Instant Classic podcast, Nancy. I'm Allison Stewart, and this is All of It. Stay with us. Joan of Arc was born in 1412 in a small village in northeast France, began hearing divine voices by the age of 13. Just a few years later, she's leading French forces against the English, turning the tide of the Hundred Years' War, and by 1431, after being captured, she was burned at the stake. She was ultimately made into a saint. It's quite a life for a teenager, but can you imagine what it was like for her mom? That's the subject of Jane Anderson's play Mother of the Maid, which takes a modern look at raising a precocious teenager, Joan the Maid of Orleans, who goes on to become a celebrity of sorts. The play stars Glenn Close as Isabel Arc. Joan's mom is now playing at the Public Theater through December 23rd. It was written by Jane Anderson and directed by Matthew Penn, who are both in studio today. Nice to see you.
A pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for coming. Jane, you were obsessed with Joan of Arc when you were a girl, right? How did you first learn about her, and what was it about her?
Well, here's the thing. I was a gay girl growing up, and every tomboy, every, not even gay girls, independent girls loved Joan of Arc because she symbolized adventure, getting to dress however you want, going out into the world and conquering it and not having to live a traditional role. So I was obsessed with her. She, you know, for years, when I was a baby actress in New York, you know, I did the Joan of Arc monologues, the Shaw's monologue. But then when I became a mother, I started to think about how difficult it was for my own mother to raise a girl like me. And I found the mother's character far more fascinating than Joan, who's been basically written to death.
And when you thought about the mother, what kind of issues did you believe she would be tackling with, aside from the parenting issues?
Well, just think about this. The Arc family were lower class, illiterate peasants. Isabel Arc never went anywhere. She was stuck in the little town of Domremy. There were horrible raids coming through. So here's a woman who has never seen beyond. And a lot of, I would say, mothers in tiny towns who are lower income and don't have other opportunities will often live through their children. And for Isabel Arc to first be outraged by this idea of Joan going out and leading an army and then being told she's special, and the notion of releasing your daughter to the outer world to do things you've never gotten to do, and then the world turns on your daughter and you have to deal with that. So it's a really universal portrait of what it is to raise your children, live through them, and try to protect them.
I'd love to ask you about your choice of language, because the modernisms come in. One of my favorite lines is like, "I'm seeing visions, Ma." You know, there's this that Joan in this play often speaks like a teenager would speak today.
Yes. Well, Matt, we can talk to this. We worked a lot during rehearsal and trying to get a notion of peasant speak. My notion was that these people work on the farm, they work with animals, they don't read or write, so their language is very basic, as opposed to the upper class people who are in the play. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Matt, you can talk about our struggles and our adventures during rehearsal trying to, you know, find a common language for the Arc family.
Right. You really try to search for a coherent sound for a family, mm-hmm. because there they are. They are a family, and they would share a kind of rhythm of speaking, a kind of idea about speaking, and it was interesting because the play has a certain kind of wonderful colloquial quality that resonates, as you say, today and 500 years ago. And so we had to search for that. But, you know, the play for me has just been about this extraordinary, the boundless love that you have for your child. No matter who they grow to be, no matter what expectation of yours you had that they then defy, mm-hmm. in quotations, it really is about how you as a parent, that your love hopefully transcends every expectation that perhaps may not be met. Our children may be, have a different idea about sexuality or politics or participation, or, but you love them.
That's one of the interesting things about Joan's father. He shows his love through his anger and through not being on board. He wants to protect his daughter in some way, right?
Yes, Jacques Arc looks brutal in the beginning because when he finds out about this soldiering thing, he beats her. When I did a lot of research about Joan of Arc, and her actual father told her brothers to go drown her in the pond. And we can interpret that as brutality, but what Jacques Arc is, a canny man who sees through the church trying to convince them all that she's a saint. And he knows that if he lets his daughter go, she will have a far more horrible ending than a simple beating with a stick. His rage, his stubbornness is also out of love, and that was very important for me.
We're speaking with Jane Anderson and Matthew Penn. Jane wrote Mother the Maid and Matthew directed. It's at the Public Theater right now. Matthew, the staging is at the Public, it's intimate. You're right there. You feel like you're actually in their home. What does working in a small, intimate space allow you to do as a director and allow you to help your actors with?
Well, the Ansbacher is a fascinating theater because you have audiences really on three sides, and you have access to stages really in four major entrances. And so I was walking out of the theater the other night at intermission, and I heard a wife say to her husband, "Oh, my God. Glenn Close is right there." And both because of the power of the play emotionally that Jane has written and that these actors have inhabited, and the experience of being literally in what feels like their living room with Glenn and every other fine actor that we have in that cast, an arm's reach away, I think it gives you an experience in the theater that is quite different from if you're going to a Broadway house and you're sitting 30 rows back, and the play can be spectacular. But here you truly, truly have a very intimate experience and connection with those actors. And so it was a pleasure to stage. It really was.
What did you like about seeing your play in this intimate space?
Oh, I love intimate spaces. As a short person, sitting way back in a Broadway theater and not being able to see is my ultimate frustration. It's also beautiful stadium seating, so you know you get to experience these actors, and because you know it's a very personal play in the guise of a historic drama. So the intimacy is very important for me.
I'm curious, a lot of what takes place has to happen in the audience's imagination. The battles, you never meet the kings. It's a lot of audio. Tell me a little bit about that decision. Is that in the playwriting or was that in the direction?
Well, it's really, it's both, but I will say this. You know, what interested me about this play was this family, that it was the story of the family. And obviously the story of a journey we know so well, but not through the eyes of Joan, but through the eyes of her mother. And so it seemed to me, as we were kind of, Jane and I were talking about it and conceiving it, that, you know, seeing the king, seeing the battle, seeing the all those things we kind of know were in a way secondary to the idea of who are these people and how are they functioning and how is it making an impact on them. So that was very much a part of how we decided to approach the staging of it, the idea of it, the set conception by John Lee Beatty is extraordinary. That was really kind of the essence of it, which is who are these people, you know?
Yeah. The play was staged in 2015, is that right, in Lenox, Mass. What's changed between that staging and this one we're seeing in New York?
A huge element. In that version, I had written the character of Saint Catherine, the saint who appears to Joan, and I used her as a device, almost like a stage manager. And the language I gave her was very, very contemporary, and she kind of narrated the play. That character never really worked, and that character took the point of view away from Isabel Arc, and it also interrupted the intimacy of the play. Sometimes us playwrights are so afraid of looking old-fashioned that we'll, you know, write up a character that looks really clever and hip and out there, and it just gets in the way with what you're really trying to say. So I just pulled her out.
You just decided that was that.
That was that, and I'm
was
so
that hard?
Happy. It was in the beginning because she got laughs in Lenox, and I'll just say again, playwrights don't like to give up laughs. But we found ultimately she, you know, and we had a wonderful actress playing her, and she had a really hard time nailing down the character, and you learn that if several actresses can't solve a character, there's something wrong with it. And also, I wanted to shift the point of view entirely to Isabel Arc, especially when I had Glenn Close playing her, which is really hard on Glenn Close because she's in every single scene.
Every scene.
And does a magnificent job.
For you as a director, your playwright comes and says, guess what? I'm losing a whole character. Now it's your turn.
Well, what was interesting, you know, was that she was often the segue between scenes. You know, you would have a scene, and then you would go to St. Catherine, wherever she would be, on a hilltop, whatever, and then you would come into the next scene. So suddenly those sorts of segues were gone. And, you know, one of the first things I said to John Lee Beatty, our set designer, is, okay, so how do we do this, you know? I said, here's my challenge as a director. Here are my ideas. And John developed a set which takes us to different locations in kind of a magical way. And sometimes just watching that is transformative between scenes. So it changed it a lot. But as Jane says, the play is the mother of the maid. And at a certain point, as a director, as a writer, you got to go, you know what? That's the main road on the highway, so let's take it.
That's the title of the play, so let's stick with it. We're speaking with Matthew Penn, who directed Mother the Maid, and Jane Anderson, who wrote it. And you mentioned Glenn Close. You know, it's when she comes on stage, the first person you see, the audience, there's just, you know, an electricity that goes through the audience. I'm interested as a director. So you have someone like Glenn Close, six-time Academy Award nominee, just has made iconic roles. And then you have the young woman, is it Grace Van Patten? She mm-hmm. she plays yes. Joan, and she's very much at the beginning of her adult career. Mm-hmm. She's been a child actor. How do you negotiate that difference? Or do you just say, you're actors, and we're just going from the beginning point of you are actors?
You know, that's a great question. The wonderful thing about Glenn is that she just comes to work. And she wants you to be on your game. She wants everybody else to be on their game. And Grace and Glenn knew each other just a little bit, which helped.
They were in a film together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can be a very, you know, broken experience because films are scheduled in all kinds of wacky ways. So you can be in a film with somebody and hardly
see
them.
See them.
But, you know, Grace right away, she's aptly named, I will tell you that, because to have the poise that she's had working opposite one of the great actresses of our time in virtually every scene she's in is a challenge for anybody. To be 21 and have that, and to be performing at such a high level and with so much talent and passion it's great. So the truth was, I asked everybody to be the artist that they are. And I was prepared for what happens if there's a little inequity here. Never happened. They came to work, and Glenn embraced everybody.
That's great. Because you mentioned Grace's age, there's another sort of other sort of theme in the play, or at least to me, it felt like a theme in the play of celebrity at a young age, or
yes.
getting a lot of responsibility and what it can do to you and how you perceive the world. Am I right?
Yes, and what it does to your family. I wrote also Joan's older brother, Pierre. And older brothers are used to telling younger sisters what to do. And this younger sister surpasses him. But he rides her coattails. He gets a full suit of armor. He's in battle with her. But what does that do to an older brother who is now caught in the celebrity of his little sister? What does it do to the mom who suddenly feels special herself? And I'm sure there are a lot of mothers of famous actresses out there who would deeply relate to this piece. You feel special, but then when you see the world turn against your girl, it's five times as painful.
I want to mention, you know, you both have worked in television and on many projects, and I want to play a little bit, Jane, of your Emmy Award winning sweet speech. You won the Emmy Award for Olive
You're
Kitteridge.
Gonna play that?
There's this great what? Little section. I just want to
really?
Play it because I think it's important to the work you do.
First, let me just acknowledge all my fellow writers out there who are nominated tonight. We all face that horrible, horrible blank page, and we're here, and we solved our script, so isn't that remarkable?
The blank page. What do you do when you're stuck?
I show up at my desk every morning like a banker shows up for work. I'm fully dressed, I'm showered, I'm clean, I'm ready to go. And that's what I've learned over the years and what I tell young writers, just show up. And there are days where I don't solve it. And there are days where at the end of the day I just feel wretched. I have no immediate words of wisdom for anybody about writer's block. But all I can say is it happens to all of us, no matter how long you've been writing. And what I do, I just say to myself, why am I writing this in the first place? And if the answer is I'm writing this because it is so deeply important to me, then I'll keep going.
Is there a director's version of writer's block? Is there a director's block?
Well, I always actually start the first day of rehearsal acknowledging that the writer has done, I think, the bravest thing that anybody ever does in the theater or film, which is they have sat down to a blank page. And without that act of courage, none of us would be here. You know, directorially, first of all, you got to have a passion for it. So I read this play. We were introduced by a common friend. Jane sent me the play. I got to the last page. I had tears coming down my eyes. I picked up the phone. I called Jane. I said, I want to do this play. So in a strange way for me, the first response is, does it touch my heart? Does it touch my heart? And if it does, strangely, ways to do it, ways to conceive, start to come to me. I start to sort of visualize, oh, this could be this or that could be that. And obviously, you try on 100 ideas and throw out 90, and 10 stick. But it really starts with, does it touch my heart? Why am I telling this story? And you ask that question in a way as a director, you have to say, okay, so this is my story in a way too. Why am I telling this story? And, you know, like I said, for me, it is about the boundless love that a parent has for a child. You know, that's part of what I'm telling, why I'm telling the story.
Matthew Penn, director of Mother of a Maid, and Jane Anderson, writer of Mother of a Maid, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Really a pleasure. Mother Great to be on one's favorite radio station.
Yay, we like WMYC, you go.
We like that. Mother of a Maid is at the Public Theater through December 23rd. Coming up, they make you laugh, cry, and laugh again. Kathy Tu and Tobin Lowe, the host of the WNYC podcast, Nancy. They'll be with us after the break. This is All of It. The WNYC podcast Nancy first aired in April of last year, with stories of its co-hosts and close friends, Kathy Tu and Tobin Lowe, coming out to their parents. And the way that coming out was just not difficult and awkward, but it was a process that sometimes had to be repeated. Since that first episode, Nancy has featured episodes that are simultaneously hilarious and touching and very, very real, like the one on how to make friends, or the story of the Marine who saved President Ford's life and in the process was outed before the whole country, and a personal interview with Lena Waithe. Now season four is out with two new episodes that you can find in your podcatcher. We're so happy it brings Kathy Tu and Tobin Lowe to the show. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
So let's start with season four.
Yes.
It follows the story of Jason Kim. I listened to it this morning as I walked to work. Mm-hmm. Who is he and why did you want to make him the first episode?
Well, so Jason's actually a friend of mine, and we were getting coffee together probably about a year ago at this point, and we were just talking about things he was working on and sort of what was going on in his life, and at the very end of coffee, he said, oh, I'm about to go to St. Louis. I have this weird thing with my dad. And he started telling me the story about how his dad moved the family from Korea when Jason was a kid to the States, and it sort of caused this change in his dad, where his dad sort of stopped speaking altogether. And so they've had this very strained relationship ever since Jason was a kid, that where they don't communicate very much at all. And the story is really about this phone call 3 years ago where Jason's dad called him and out of nowhere said, I have kidney failure, and I'm actually in desperate need of a transplant. So Jason did what I think a lot of us would do in that situation is he went and got tested to see if he was a match, and he was. And so he calls his dad back and he says, I'm a match. I can save your life. And his dad says, absolutely not. And he won't tell him why he keeps saying no. It's this very strange situation that they've been in for basically the last 2 years.
And he's sort of wrecked inside by it slowly.
Yes, absolutely. It's a really, I can't even imagine, I put myself in Jason's shoes, what it would be like to have someone who I love say no to this very life-changing thing, but also not be able or willing to tell me why.
Let's take a listen to a little bit of it.
The last year and a half of my life has been me trying to convince my dad to take my kidney. And it happens everywhere. We'll be out eating ramen and I'll be like, so about this kidney, Dad, what do you think? We'll be walking down the street and I'll say, so you know that I could still give you my kidney, right? And at this point, it feels like I'm doing an ongoing bit. And always the answer is no. I never know why, and he won't say.
So let's not spoil it. I want people to listen to it. Kathy, episode two is a story that you pursued,
yeah.
And it's about music.
Music. So I would say maybe like 8 years ago, I started law school, and I was going through a tough time. Law school was difficult. I had no friends yet. I went through a breakup. A lot of things were not going well in my life until I found this singer-songwriter named Katie Herzig based in Nashville. And her music to me was just the most relaxing, calming thing in the world. But at the same time, her lyrics are really opaque and to me kind of confusing. And maybe it was because what I was going through, but I felt like she was also working through something. And I didn't know what it was, but I was worried about her. And I just really wanted to know what was happening.
That's so empathetic of you.
Yeah.
Fast forward to like very recently, I see an Instagram post and I was like, I need to talk to her to verify something. And maybe that's a clip that we can play.
All right, let's take a listen.
Suddenly I have this thing that was kind of a secret and I'd never had a secret because, and the reason it kind of was because I was like, well, it's not going to happen. So let's just not bother telling people. And it's just not having a secret in life or having like to withhold parts of yourself is just, it eats away at your freedom. I hated that feeling so much.
I
didn't have a
question. I loved her music too.
Oh,
I mean,
my
aside
God.
From this, the story is really moving and then the music's great too.
The music, I still listen to it now and it brings me back. It still calms me now. I love it.
And it's so funny. You mentioned this in the episode that it's on Grey's Anatomy a lot.
Yes. Which, by the way, is back for season 15.
Okay, easy.
Well, you guys will get to season 15 as well. So the secret, this is sort of a nice segue into the engagement project that you guys are working on. Explain to our listeners, because some of them may want to get involved with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're talking about, you know, sort of the stories that we love and what is sort of like the connecting thread between a lot of the stuff that appears on Nancy. And one of the things that we like to talk a lot about is these conversations that happen between two people who might, you know, to the outside world be as close as can be, or family or lovers or friends. But there's one conversation that they're not having that could actually bring them so much closer. And you hear that in Jason's story. You hear that in Kathy's story. So we thought, why not? Why don't we open up this idea to our listeners? Is there something that you've been meaning to tell someone? The project is called I've Been Meaning to Tell You. And you can go to nancypodcast.org/tell, T-E-L-L. And basically, you can share what is that thing that you're withholding from somebody that would actually be really freeing to share and actually talk about.
Kathy, what are some examples?
So we've heard from a couple different people, and I don't want to get into very specific examples because some of them are anonymous and
of course
they want to keep it to themselves. But they range like so wildly between something really simple, like a thing they should have mentioned at some point in their life that's just funny, to very emotional conversations that they wanted to have with their parents or grandparents. It just, the range of it has really surprised me.
Are any of them amusing at all? Because I'm thinking about, I had a boyfriend that we used to have this thing. We say, okay, 60 seconds of honesty, where you could just say what happened.
How dangerous.
Well, it was what he said to me was, I had a pair of pants I liked that I thought were so cool. And he said, I wouldn't wear them to a party.
That's so
so I'm just wondering if it were any that just sort of, that had, you know, heart to them, but were also humorous.
One of my favorite ones had to do with somebody basically telling their parents that so you may have interpreted something as a fungal infection or, you know, something wrong with my skin. It was actually hickeys. So there was a little bit of a, you just need to know how you remember that is not exactly what happened.
Aww. Have these conversations worked for people, Kathy?
Have they worked for people? So we're not at a stage yet where we're like following up with people yet.
Okay.
But that is the next stage of our project. At some, maybe 4 to 6 weeks later, we're going to have an episode all about this where we'll be able to follow a couple people as they tell their as they tell the person that they want to tell, the thing that they want, they've been meaning to tell.
We're speaking with Tobin Lowe and Kathy Tu, the co-hosts of the WNYC podcast, Nancy. So you guys started this podcast and it just kind of blew up. You have great reviews. You're on people's lists of podcasts to listen to. When you first started, what was the hole you guys were trying to fill? What didn't you hear or see that you felt needed to be addressed?
Well, I think one of the things you mentioned is we started the series, or we started our show, with our coming out stories. And that was actually like a very pointed decision that we made, because I think what we saw a lot of is with LGBT stories, with queer stories, there's a lot of focus on like someone comes out, and then there's a reaction, and that's the story. And so our goal with the show and where we started was, okay, coming out is actually the beginning of a lifelong process. You may come out a million times about different things. It's something you're constantly figuring out and wrestling with. And so I think the stories that we're attracted to on the show are about queerness as something that you're constantly figuring out, and not something that you sort of declare once, and then it's over, and everything's good.
As you're creating this, Kathy, you know, along the way you make decisions and you creatively turn the ship another way. What are some of the changes that have happened in the podcast that you think have made it a better podcast, or you realize we were not accomplishing what we wanted to accomplish?
I think it's more of, so Tobin and I appear in every single episode because we're the ones that are sort of taking you through other people's stories. But I think we are really, really conscious of letting other people tell their own stories instead of having us always in there being the ones to tell their story. That's a thing that we started from the beginning, and I'm really proud that we continue to do stories in that way. And I don't think that's a thing that we will ever change.
As you have heard from people from across the country who are invested in the podcast, what does they tell you that they want to hear? Do they ever say to you, hey, guys, can you do this? Hey, guys, can you do that?
Oh, man. So many times. And we hear you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things about when you enter a space where there's not enough representation and not enough people covering stories, you're going to hear from a lot of people who say, hey, you didn't cover the full spectrum, or the way you did that story, you left me out. And the thing is, they're absolutely right. You know, mm-hmm. And so a part of doing this work is accepting that and saying, cool, I hear you. We're going to do better next time, and we're going to keep telling stories, and hopefully we will get around to everything.
Got about 30 seconds left. What story do you think needs to be told that hasn't been told?
Oh, my God. Oh, that's so hard. Can I show you a spreadsheet?
I will say really quickly, I don't think there's enough coverage of violence against trans women of color, which mm-hmm. is constantly a story. It's like every year the number grows. And so that is a very important thing that we need to be talking about more.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you that again when you come on the show the next time. Okay. Tobin Low and Kathy Tu, co-hosts of the WNYC podcast, Nancy. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we'll be back after the news.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.